Well, welcome to this second of our media conferences, and thank you again for being here. You see that, according to plan, the Archbishop of Canterbury is with us, and it's our intention to give most of the time in the conference today to the Archbishop, though we also have Melinda Whalen with us from the Spouses Conference, and after the Archbishop has spoken to you, we'll give Melinda a couple of minutes to say what she would like to say about where the spouses are. I would ask you to understand that today is one of the days when the program sessions happen at 2 o'clock, so Melinda needs to get away and both the Archbishop and I need to get away. So we'll plan to bring things to a conclusion round about 2 or just a few minutes after. If you would bear with us, that would be appreciated. I'll ask the Archbishop to make some opening remarks to tell you what he would like to tell you, and then he's happy to take questions, and I'll assist him with identifying people in the question time. Might I just say, by way of introduction, that unanimously the bishops I've spoken to have been extraordinarily grateful for the input that the Archbishop of Canterbury has provided in the retreat days. The Archbishop won't thank me for saying this, and I don't do it to embarrass him, but to convey something of the mood of the Lambeth Conference at its beginning. The Archbishop stood yesterday to address the plenary session and began by apologising for the amount of listening to him that the bishops had to do in the early days of the conference. And that apology was greeted with a spontaneous standing ovation from all the bishops present. So even those bishops who take a different view on some issues to the view that the Archbishop himself takes are greatly and deeply appreciative of the leadership he's exercising among us. So with those, I hope, not too embarrassing words, Archbishop, I invite you to address the conference.
Thank you. Yes, I should have let the pink drain from my cheeks, I think. Thank you all for being here this afternoon. I'd like just to say a very few words of framing for today, a little bit about the plenary yesterday and what I myself hoped to be conveying in that, and a little bit about the background to today's agenda. The plenary was, of course, as everybody recognised, a moment of what you might call gear change in the life of the conference. We'd had a fairly intensive experience of gathering together, praying together, and deliberately not engaging with a business agenda. But yesterday was the point at which we had to be clearer about the methods we were using, why we were using them, and what the processes would be to arrive at some sort of statement, some sort of reflection that could claim to speak for the whole conference. So in what I was saying yesterday, I had two or three thoughts particularly in mind. One was to say something about the process we've adopted, the much-discussed Indaba process. And I noted in what I said that although some people had said that this didn't look like a very effective way of addressing tough issues, nonetheless, the older methods we'd used didn't seem to be terribly successful either, so it was at least worth trying something which allowed quite deliberately every single voice to be heard as part of the process, and not to rely too heavily on particular kinds, particular cultures of conference life. So that's part of the background to that. And then, of course, I wanted to flag up some of the resources there would be around in looking at the divisive and sensitive issues in the background of the conference. So it was a chance to introduce the Covenant Working Group and the Windsor Continuation Group, the two groups that are, in some sense, doing some of the toughest work on the divisive issues and how we handle them. That was a chance for people to see who was involved in this and begin to get to grips with the agenda as they saw it. So they were invited to share some initial perceptions. The third thing I wanted to do yesterday was just to sketch a little bit further the vision that I hoped the conference could work with and seek to achieve, a vision of, as I think I put it, a unity that was achieved not by coercion but by consent, with all that that meant of challenges to everybody involved. But I said, as I believe, that is a vision worth working for and a vision worth sharing with the whole of our ecumenical set of partners. So that was how I understood the task of the plenary and the first address that I gave and all the business that we did yesterday afternoon. Today we're launching in with some reflections on Anglican identity, the bishop and Anglican identity. And part of the background to that is the working party on theological education that was set up by the primates a couple of years ago. When I first became archbishop, I said that one of my priorities would be theological education, both in Britain and more widely. That is, trying to set in train some of the processes, some of the institutions that would go on delivering real excellence worldwide in education, so that we were not dependent on a small number of particularly northern and western institutions, but could guarantee the same sorts of theological excellence worldwide. And as part of the work of that theological education in the Anglican Communion Working Group, various documents appeared which spelled out some of the expectations for ministerial education. And those of you who've seen the Lambeth Reader will have perhaps noticed that on pages 28 following, you'll see some of the background to this and what was said about the bishops as a target group in theological education there. And there are several pages of really rather formidable requirements for what makes a good bishop, which probably ought to make most of us want to resign straight away. But all of that is part of what is feeding in to today's discussion. And I think that's all I want to say by way of introduction. I'm very happy to take questions now.
This mic's on, I think. Now, we'll use the same method through these conferences. We'll try and give as many people an opportunity to ask one question before we come back for second bites. In the front row here, yes.
What is your message to the absentees, and is the Anglican Church heading for schism?
Oh, nice straightforward question. What is my message? We're sorry you're not here. And I think that the great pity is that to have those voices in the discussion as we have conceived it would have been, I think, for everybody, a healing and a helpful thing, though also a difficult one. Are we heading for schism? Well, let's see. If this is the end of the Anglican Communion, I don't think anyone's told most of the people here.
Thank you. Yes? Just tell us who you are and where you're from.
It's a very interesting question, actually, because it seems to me that a lot of the religious conflicts we see around the world are intensified by ignorance and prejudice, by the incapacity to get inside the skin both of your own tradition and of others. Education is part of making religion a resource for peace rather than a menace here. So I would see this as absolutely key to that task.
Thank you.
Well, I think we argue. That's to say, we continue to make the case and see whether what emerges in terms of the covenant discussions in the next couple of weeks will help that forward. We're not at the end of that process yet.
Ruth?
I deliberately used a fairly general word in terms of council with a lowercase rather than an uppercase. It's not that I want to see the Lambeth Conference becoming a governing council, but among the covenant proposals and among some of the other documents around, there are suggestions for some further international bodies that could act as clearinghouses for debate, as sources of clear advice to myself or the primates. So it's at that level that I'm thinking of it.
Thank you.
Your conference, as it were.
Sorry, name?
Oh, sorry, beg your pardon, George Pitcher, Telegraph. Your conference, of course, started with the retreat, so I'm conscious that you're sort of here on day two, and you're on day five. Could you indicate, as of day five, what you think the conference has achieved so far?
I think it's achieved a level of spiritual cohesion. That's to say, people have simply had the experience of praying together quite intensively for a few days and meeting, if I can put it like this, off agenda. You know, it's not been a matter of a heavily agendaed few days. I think that's an important building block for anything else that happens during the conference, and that, of course, was the point of it. Not to distract anybody from issues, but to say, as I've said now countless times, we can't discuss these issues as Christian pastors without doing some prayer and quiet together. So I think it has done what I hoped it would, to give people a common base, a common culture. Simply being in the cathedral mattered quite a bit. And I think the cathedral did most of the work last week.
Thank you. I'm trying to go side to side, so we'll take you and then George. Yep.
Toby Cohen, Tokyo newspaper. There were concerns voiced at the end of the recent General Synod that following the advice of both of the women bishops, the position of the Church of England would be undermined as it came into the conference, particularly the Bishop of Durham was very concerned about that. Do you feel that's been the case?
I'm not sure that I do. I think there is certainly a huge bit of unfinished business for the Church of England after the General Synod, in the sense that pastorally so many people felt, well, as many people maybe felt alienated or grieved by the way the decision emerged as felt elated by the step forward that had been taken. So the Church of England has got work to do there. I don't feel, though, that it has somehow made us enter this conference as a kind of bleeding, hunted animal with arrows in its side. I think we're here as the pastors of the English dioceses meeting with our brothers and sisters, and I think it's been a hugely important factor in that the pre-conference hospitality has built strong relationships between the English dioceses, and indeed the British and Irish dioceses generally, and bishops from overseas. That, I think, easily offsets any of the sense of difficulty or unfinishedness in the Church of England's context.
Thank you, George.
George Conger, Jewish newspaper. Dr. Williams, on Saturday you said the ecumenical participants were full participants in the conference, and their presence and the different traditions would serve to provoke and deepen the journey into the divine. Mm-hmm. Given that some of them, the Salvation Army has an Anglican view of the sacraments and the Armenians have a different view of Christology, they're present and fully participating, yet Gene Robinson is not. For those who would say that homosexuality is of more importance than Christology or the sacraments, how do you reconcile those two? Why are they here and he's not?
I could answer with a long disquisition on Armenian Christology, but I think I'd probably better not for the tolerance of my audience. The ecumenical participants are here precisely on that ticket. They are representing their churches as sister communions, as friends. They're there because they are Armenian Orthodox or Salvation Army. The problem that we faced within the Anglican Communion is that bishops gathering for the Lambeth Conference represent not only their diocese, but their participation in the fellowship of worldwide Anglican Christians. Where there are bishops whose participation in that worldwide fellowship is, for one reason or another, questionable, that's a reason for questioning their participation here, and that's the rationale.
Someone from this side, yes, sir, in the front.
I think you're very free to.
Okay, fine. You know, Archbishop, there's a thing I do about Norbert Kanonga.
I do.
Are you worried that there could be a trend set by him of breaking from Canterbury and the more orthodox wing of the Anglican community and cementing relationships with people like Mugabe, who have their own agenda when it comes to church affairs?
Well, I don't see any sign of a trend in that direction. And Bishop Kanonga, I think by any standards, was a rather extreme representative of that uncritical approach to his own government. I think, frankly, it's not a problem restricted to Zimbabwe. There are other contexts, and Sudan is one, where unscrupulous people within the church have used alliance with the government as a way of reinforcing interchurch divisions. I think that is a very dangerous trend, and it needs to be challenged wherever it crops up.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes. Gamberini from Civita Cattolica, Rome. In your address yesterday, you mentioned one of the criterion for the covenant, how do we recognize each other ministry? Mm. And you said your conviction is that the Anglican Communion ordains men and women to one in ministry in one body of Christ. Now, in the future, if parishes, dioceses, provinces of the Anglican Communion do not want to ordain women to the priesthood or the episcopate, are not able to sign the Anglican Covenant, and how do you relate with Bertone's address to you regarding especially this ministry?
That's quite a complicated one, isn't it? But let me try. I think that what we have, let's say, in the Church of England at the moment is a situation where some members of the Church of England still have questions about the nature of the priestly ministry exercised by women in the church. The fact is, though, that such people will still recognize that a ministry is being exercised, that whether it's fully integrated with their own vision of ministry or not is real. And I'd be worried, I think, if those who had reservations about the ordination of women, let's say, were just to respond, I don't recognize that there's a ministry going on, a church ministry. So we have a kind of low-level recognition, which has survived in the Church of England in spite of a lot of pressures. And that's why I don't see this as an absolute deal-breaker in that sense. Now, I'm very conscious of what the Secretary of State has written, and indeed what I've heard directly from other friends in Rome and others who we've been in dialogue with. And I'm aware that this is not an issue that is going to go away in a hurry. Indeed, I'm slightly conscious that some issues around the ordination of women to the priesthood are perhaps, once again, just a little bit more prominent than even 5 years ago in the minds of some people in Rome. So we have a lot of theological discussion still ahead of us there. But what I've always felt to be important there is that we have in our common resource as Roman Catholics and Anglicans, statements about the ministry through archic, which have given us, the field within which we discuss. We recognize each other thus far. And if we lost that, that would be very serious, but we haven't, and I don't intend to.
Thank you. I think, David, you were next.
Archbishop, as the sexuality issue seems to be the elephant in the sacristy, my question would be, what counts for you as wrong in sexual behavior?
What counts for me as wrong in sexual behavior would be, first of all, any relationship which is outside the covenant, public covenant, of mutual support and love in the presence of God. That's to say, I don't believe that sex outside marriage is as God purposes it. I don't believe that sex outside marriage is as God purposes it. Now, the question of same-sex relations, the Anglican Communion has made its position corporately clear through the Lambeth Conference and through all the things we've been going through in recent years. And as Archbishop, that is where I stand. That is the discipline I'm committed to stand with.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I think you'd have to ask the participants about what it felt like. Obviously, the conference is a huge challenge. I mean, let's be candid, there's no way of avoiding that. Equally, I would want to say that it's never just dependent on an archbishop. A Lambeth conference depends on the participants. I said yesterday, we all have to do the work. And just as significantly, I think, millions of people are praying very, very hard about this conference, and whatever has emerged in the last few days, I feel bound to ascribe to their prayers and their support, as well as to the goodwill of people here and their willingness to go on together in prayer.
Yes, sir.
Todd Wetzel, Anglican Voice. Two parts. First part is, if Gene Robinson, for Anglican reasons, was not invited, why were his consecrators invited?
Mm-hmm.
First part. Second part, it seems that they were invited when Kappa and a number of other large bodies of Anglicans had already indicated that if they were invited, they could not in good conscience come. So the voices of the majority of Anglicans in the world is now unrepresented here.
Your question being?
I'd like to hear your comment to that second part.
Well, let me answer the first question. Gene Robinson's consecrators. I think the difficulty that I faced and some others faced was, of those who consecrated Gene Robinson, some small number had later expressed the wish that they hadn't. Some have retired. And, of course, a great many American bishops have come into office since then. The American House of Bishops corporately asked for forgiveness for offence caused last year. Now, you'll remember that I circulated all the provinces last year with a request as to whether people thought this was a satisfactory response to the concerns expressed. And you'll be aware that both the Joint Standing Committee and 50%, perhaps slightly more, of the provinces said, well, that's probably all right. Now, that was my base for saying, I don't think I want to go down the list of consecrators and say, yes, no, well, possibly, and distinguish. The House of Bishops corporately said something which not everybody thought was adequate, but many did. That was the basis on which I worked with that one. The question about Kappa and other bodies is a difficult one, because the fact is, of course, all primates and all provinces are regarded constitutionally as having equal voice. And I wasn't quite sure what the logic would be if I said, well, if you're more than 7 million as a province, your voice on this ought to matter more. A difficult judgment, and I don't pretend it's simple, but that's some of the thinking behind it.
I think we've got time for two more questions from the Archbishop. We'll take you, sir, and you, sir, and then we'll hear from the spouses.
I understand what you mean, that there is a question about the legitimacy, so to speak, of what emerges from this. It's a point I put as strongly as I can to those who are not here, in fact, that if they want their voice incorporated in this, this is the way to do it. I think people will have to make the judgment as to whether those provinces that are not here have, so to speak, a coherent alternative to what the communion has gathered here is saying and wanting to do. Clearly, as I've indicated earlier, this isn't the end of the story. And it's not that the provinces who are absent have said, we want to pull out from the Anglican Communion, this is it. They've expressed grave disquiet and serious criticism, which has to be responded to and engaged with in the months and the years ahead.
Thank you, yes, sir.
Thank you. Your Grace, Craig O'Brien, the Anglican Planet. In your presidential address, you referred to common prayer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very interesting. Thank you. Its context, its background, was partly what I said in one of the retreat addresses, that maybe we would have been less likely to get to a standoff in the communion if shared patterns of prayer, shared disciplines of prayer, had been a bit more part of the routine for everybody. And indeed, if every bishop in the communion shared a common rule of life with two or three others as, you know, as a basis for understanding. The Book of Common Prayer, for a long time, has, of course, been the foundation of all the Anglican liturgies across the communion, and you can still see the bones sticking through in some places. I think if we were to lose completely the sense that there ought to be a convergence in the forms of Anglican liturgy, we would be badly off. The Book of Common Prayer remains, as we say in our official formulas, one of the standards of belief. And I think that's important. It doesn't mean that everybody has to use it. It means that there it is as the touchstone. And I think most people involved in the International Anglican Liturgical Networks would say it is of importance not to lose that sense of a common touchstone, a convergent pattern. And I would want to add, perhaps, not just what we say, but what I call rule of life, which is how often you pray, how often you take spiritual direction, that sort of thing, so that there's a cohesion at a deeper level.
Well, thank you very much, Archbishop. We're on track to finish at 2. If you need to get away now, we're
how
about
are we doing?
4 minutes to 2.
We could take one more question, maybe.
Well, Melinda, we're going to try and get Melinda away by 2 as well. Would you like to leave now, Archbishop, or stay and hear what's happening in the Spouses Conference? That was my question, really.
Right, yes.
Thank you. Melinda, thank you. We're all very interested in what's happening in the Spouses Conference. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Melinda Whalen. My husband is the Bishop of the Convocation of American Churches in Europe, and we are stationed in Paris. I am very honored to have been part of the Spouses Planning Group for this Lambeth Conference for the past 2 years. We have been working very, very hard during this time with a very international group, including women from Africa, from Myanmar, from England, of course, from the United States. And we have been working to design a conference which would meet the varied needs of women within the Anglican Communion, keeping in mind that many of our sisters and brothers do not have the opportunity to get together with their fellow spouses. They do not have the chance to have additional education. They do not have the chance to further their knowledge in very practical means as well as spiritual disciplines. So we have designed a varied program, a program with many aspects, something for almost everyone, from making things to learning management skills to studying deeper various issues on the ecology and things of great interest to women. For example, today we were just talking for the second day about the many parts of me. We are studying this week what makes us spouses of bishops. What are the things that go into that? And today our topic was married life. So we addressed many of the challenges, the joys, the sorrows, the difficulties of being married to these very particular species called bishops. So we heard from two wives. We heard from Lily Lai, who is the wife of the Bishop of Taiwan, and she talked very succinctly about the way that marriage is treated in Taiwan, her experiences as the wife of the bishop in Taiwan, the joys that she has experienced, some of the challenges she has experienced, and the blessings that have come out of her life as bishop, as the wife of the Bishop of Taiwan. Then we also heard from Dr. Timea Sioko from Pretoria, South Africa. She is also an incredibly interesting woman. She is a professional pharmacologist. She has a very professional life in South Africa and related to us many very interesting stories about the difficulty of being a professional woman and a clergy spouse. So we will be continuing in this vein for the next few days. In the afternoons, we have a variety of sessions that are open to spouses. We will be doing what we call going deeper sessions. For example, that's why I will be leaving in a few minutes, because I am chairing a going deeper session where we will explore in more depth some of the issues around being married to a bishop. We have a number of very professional, as I mentioned before, very professional seminars on management training. We are teaching about microfinance. We are teaching methodologies for starting prayer groups, various kinds of ministries, to addressing the needs that our sisters and brothers have in their contexts. And I must stress that this is what we are really trying to understand as we gather in around our tables in the plenary sessions, as we gather in our Bible study groups, is to understand the gospel, to understand our lives together, to understand our work in terms of our own particular contexts in the places where we live and move and have our being. So I hope that you will take advantage of the chance to listen to some of the stories. There are remarkable stories among the spouses. Incredible, heartrending, inspiring, fabulous stories that I am sure your readers would be interested in hearing. Stories that many of them will not have heard before. So I would encourage you to ask if you can hear some of those stories, because they have not, they have touched and moved and caused us to cry and to laugh, and already in this short time to feel like we are much tighter, much more one in the spirit than we would have thought possible by this time. So.
Thank you, Melinda. You have to take a couple of questions.
Certainly.
We might just have a couple of questions. Someone who hasn't asked already. Sir?
Hello.
Yes. Can you give us a sense of what, if any, role the new book by Jane Williams is playing in the spouses' conference?
Well, at the moment, we haven't had a lot of time to sit down and read it, I must admit. But some of the people whose stories we are hearing are some of the same stories. For example, my friend Lily from Taiwan, you will see her story in the last chapter of the book. So we will be adding to these stories. At the moment, we have not had much opportunity other than the book launching on Thursday to really delve into that, but we are creating the next version of stories.
The book might be a good way for people to spot some of the spouses they might wish to talk to.
Yes.
Someone from this side? No? Someone from here? We've only got second timers. Would do two? Riazat and
surely.
Then George and then...
Sure.
Oh,
now
then.
Riazat from the
Guardian.
Yes.
Oh, I knew you were going to ask that one. I think the best thing is the privilege of being able to be with people during a variety of times in their life. Sometimes the spouses love to joke that we are always in the season of confirmation. And that is true, because we get to go to churches and see lots of confirmations. But that is a pivotal time in the life of young people. And it is such a privilege for me, especially in my context, because we function in a great number of the countries in Europe. So I get to meet Americans and other Anglophones and people who are nationals in those locations, and to share for just a piece their life in God, their life in their communities, and it's a great privilege. The worst thing is that I never see my husband. So,
last one, George. I did spot you.
George Bond, your Church of England newspaper.
Hi, George.
What would you want Mrs. Nzimbi, who was one of your conference organizing committee, who wasn't able
yes.
to come, those spouses who were not able to come, what would you hope they would hear about this conference?
That we missed them, that we missed hearing their stories, and we missed the contribution that they could have and would have made to our conference had they been here.
Okay, gang, thank you very much.